why I was a thorn in the side of some of the boys in the fourth floor of the ad building. Anyway, she said, why don't you talk to me? I said, look, I'm not carrying a Teamster card. You don't organize people by going to the boss and signing up the boss. You talk to the workers first. Mm-hmm. Well, she said, God, I thought this was marvelous. She says, I know why you're doing this. I said, why? She said, you hate your mother, and you're projecting that onto me.
There's the answer.
God. Talk about a brilliant anti-union one-liner. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so now, see, I became the president of the little local. Most of the members were secretaries working for CIO offices mm-hmm. there in Seattle. Now, the national president of this union was widely thought to be a member of the Communist Party. Probably was, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So when I got my FBI file in 1975, sure enough, the first item in there was the subject was an officer of a communist-dominated union, the CIO. They were one of the unions kicked out of the CIO mm-hmm. for communist domination.
I see. This is before the AFL and CIO joined, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Long before. They merged in, or the AFL absorbed the CIO mm-hmm. in 1955. This mm-hmm. is way back in 46 or thereabouts. So I don't think I got another job. I think I lost my enthusiasm for part-time employment after that.
So you, and then you finished your degree there.
I got the master's. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I started by saying I was going down a list of things I did not want to do. I didn't mm-hmm. want to work for a corporation. I didn't want to work for government. Some people have said, and this is why I digressed, you could have a future in the labor movement. You know, and some. A lot of the people in the Seattle CIO were communists, and they would tell tall stories about how if you join the party, and we'll make damn sure you've got a good career in the CIO, and then they'd say so-and-so, he's one of ours, and so on. I think a lot of the times he was made up out of whole cloth. I think they even told me Eleanor Roosevelt was a member. It shows you how the circle closes. And mm-hmm. the right wing says she should come in. The left wing, she says she's one of ours. Mm-hmm. So anyway, a career in the union movement was out too, because you've got to toe the party line, mm-hmm. you know. So God, I'm telling this guy, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. And he said, have you ever thought of getting a PhD in teaching? Well, with my undergraduate record and my high school record and my grade school record, which is one of goofing off, the idea of getting a PhD was so foreign to me, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. I said, mm-hmm. God, do you think I could ever make it to the PhD? Well, he said, look around at the faculty. You think you're as smart as they are? And I said, well, I sure as hell am. He says, well, then you can make it. So I applied to Yale. It's the only school I applied to. And I got a form postcard back, not even the dignity of a letter, saying thank you for applying. And they were crying for PhD candidates after the war, you know. Mm-hmm. But we don't have room for you, something. So I told a friend of mine in Seattle about this. He said, I think I could help. I said, how? Oh. Well, he said, my brother is the captain of the Yale football team, and he could run interference for you.
He had ball, huh?
And I said, Jesus, how? The head of the football team is going to recommend a guy for a PhD program. This is the last thing I would ever do. Well, he wrote to his brother, and the next thing I knew, I was invited by the chairman of the Yale alumni organization in Seattle to come down to his office. I go down to his office, and I'm waiting in the outer office where he had a big table. And this table is just loaded with Birch Society magazines and right-wing stuff. I thought, oh, geez, if this guy ever finds out I have something to do with the ACLU, my goose is cooked. But it went in, and in those days I used to wear a suit, and I, you know, looked pretty sharp. These shoes shined and all that. And I think I had a medal. You get these little metal replicas of a medal, and you put them in your coat. And I had one of those on. And that made a big impression on this guy.
And that was your war medal?
Yeah. I'll be damned if the guy didn't recommend me to Yale, and I got in. Mm-hmm. which again gives me empathy with students who want letters of recommendation, and you might say they don't deserve them.
And the way the GI Bill worked at that time, you were able to go to an Ivy League school?
Well, see, I went to Yale, and I think it ran out after the first year, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. But I had a job teaching three classes, assistant instructor, I think I was called. Mm-hmm. But they were my own classes, you know, they did everything. There were about 15 of us, all teaching small sections of beginning econ. Mm-hmm. And we were all PhD candidates, faculty. They did what the English department does, they shoved it off on grad students. But it was a great experience, and I learned a lot. You know, the best way to learn is to teach something. Yeah. So that was good. But now I had tuition paid for as part of my assignment, and a salary to go with it. So with my GI Bill and that, I lived quite comfortably. Mm-hmm. So that was a great arrangement. But here again, I had gone, the reason I wanted to go to Yale was because there was a prof in the econ department who had written a textbook in labor economics and a lot of articles and whatnot, and that's what I wanted to go into.
Mm-hmm. Who was that? Do you remember?
The guy's name?
Yeah. Or we can look it up.
No, I had it in my mm-hmm. head, and I carried a grudge against that guy for all these years. I'll be able to remember it. It'll come back to me. I had it right on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, mm-hmm. I went there because I wanted to study under this guy. Mm-hmm. Well, my wife got a job in the Labor Management Center at Yale as soon as we got there. And I think after we'd been there about 2 weeks, the head of the center, which included this prof I went there to study under, on, you know, a joint appointment. So the head of the center had a cookout or something one Sunday afternoon, nice pleasant day and whatnot. And I arrived driving I think it was a 1947 or 48 Studebaker convertible. A battleship gray or kind of a silver color with red leather and big white walled tires, you know. And the thing was just absolutely spotless all the time. So I pull up at this place, and this guy, his place was out in the country, and he had a kind of a split, what do you call those things?
Split rail? Hmm? A split rail fence?
A split rail fence, yeah. And you pull up to this fence, see, and park, and go on into the house. So I parked my car there, and I went in. But 15 minutes later, here comes this prof. Lloyd Reynolds, that was the guy's name. He arrives, and he was in a fury. It turned out he was a thin-skinned, insecure bastard, even though he was highly respected and made big money and, you know, all the rest of it, Yale prof. Well, I could see there's something's really bothering him. Somebody asked him, what's the trouble? He says, who owns that Studebaker convertible out there? Somebody says, the new guy or something. What got under his skin was he had a car just like it, but when I went out, it looked like his had been bought after somebody had run it into the ground for 15 years or so, in a mess. Mm-hmm. And to see mine just gleaming, got under his skin for some damn reason. So I started off on the wrong foot with that guy. And
you like?
We had a graduate economics club, and we would invite people from Harvard and various other places to come and give talks, you know, and then we'd discuss their talks and that. And this was held in a pretty posh graduate studies center or something like that. So I think it might have been the first one I went to. They had beauty, you know, leather chairs, overstuffed chairs, very comfortable. But there was a big crowd there, so we got there fairly early, and we wound up sitting on a couch with room for one more person. Lloyd Reynolds wound up late, so the only place he could sit was next to me on this couch. Well, I had read in the Times that day or the day before that Lloyd Reynolds had testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee as a hostile witness, not because he was under any accusation, but he'd been asked about colleagues or something, and he had stood up to this committee. So I said to him, you know, I want to commend you for that position you took with the House Un-American Activities Committee. He said, what are you talking about? I said, well, I read in the times that you stood up to the committee, and I think it's about time somebody did. Well, it certainly wasn't me, he says. And he's pissed off. Well, it turned out it was a guy named Lloyd Reynolds at Reed College in Portland. You can see how I dug myself in deeper. So I managed to do okay. I was up against guys who had gone to prep schools and Ivy League colleges. And I felt kind of intimidated at first, but I discovered fairly soon that they really weren't all that better than I was, despite my record, which on paper it was really miserable, academic record. So I was taking a course from a guy named E. White Bakke, same name as that guy who's Case Bakke in California. Yeah.
That's B-A-K-K-E?
Yeah. Well, E. White Bakke at Yale was working on a concept that he thought he could sell, or could be useful, I shouldn't put it that way, would be useful to corporations and government officials, and it was called bonds of organization. How do you get people in an organization to bond together and develop a team spirit and work cooperatively? And I think that was the point of it. So I had to do a term paper for this seminar, and I thought, I'll apply this bonds of organization theory to the econ department at Yale. So there were about, you know, maybe 15 grad students in the group there, and I interviewed all these guys, and I finished the paper. Oh, to a person, they were disgusted, absolutely disgusted with the Yale faculty. They said they didn't help them, they didn't make any effort to help them get jobs, oftentimes unprepared, treated teaching as if it was an annoyance rather than a calling, all the things that you know, might say about some faculty. So and this was unanimous, see, so I called one person and I turned the damn thing in. I'll be damned if this guy Bakke didn't make copies and circulate that to the entire Yale faculty.
Oh no!
You can imagine the kind of help I got out of those bastards. But I survived it.
Yeah. What was your dissertation on? Or how did your area
well, that's
study
another,
as it turned out?
That's another thing that disgruntled me a little bit. I thought I had a marvelous opportunity to do something that's almost the sort of thing you would do in science. And that was, I was doing the dissertation just at a time when the East Coast Longshoremen's Union was under a lot of attack for being gangster-dominated and corrupt, and et cetera. And so I thought, here's a laboratory that you're rarely going to find in social science. You study the East Coast Longshoremen's Union and the relations between the union and the employers, and the employers operate on both coasts, steamship
companies. Same ones, right.
Yeah, many of them operate the same. So you have a corrupt, gangster-dominated union on the East Coast. You have a clean, democratic, communist-led union on the West Coast. In the East Coast, the way you get hired is through a shape-up. You're familiar with that term?
No.
Well, if you work on a job that's intermittent or even casual, where you might be hired to work for 2 or 3 hours, that particular job is done, you're dismissed. Or you might work 36 hours right straight through because they want to finish that and they don't want to lay people off and hire new people. So the way you get hired is you go down to wherever it is. You see it in construction, too. Mm-hmm. You go to the job site and you get there, let's say, around 7:30 in the morning. The hiring foreman comes out of his shed or whatever it is, around 7:45 or thereabouts, and he starts picking people out of the crowd to go to work. That's a shape-up. Mm-hmm. Well, the result of that kind of hiring is, if there are 200 jobs, there are going to be 500 people down there in this mass. The shape-up derives from the idea of somebody, you've got people milling around in a kind of a formless shape. Mm-hmm. The hiring boss comes out, blows a whistle. They form a kind of a horseshoe. See, the shape-up is the horseshoe.
I see.
And then he picks people out. Well, that lends itself to all kinds of corruption. For one thing, in order to work, you're going to have to reward the hiring boss for picking you. And that takes all kinds of forms. Mm-hmm. For another thing, if organized crime wants to use this hiring method, to engage in large-scale theft from cargoes coming off ships. You make an arrangement, you get the hiring foreman in your pocket, either by threatening him or paying him. Then he is notified that people you're supposed to hire will have a toothpick on their right ear, or you know, some sign like that, and he'll pick the people. And, you know, they were making, in New York Harbor, they were making off with tons of steel, grand pianos, imported liquor, perfume. You can imagine perfume in little bottles in the box, not very big. How you could load a truck with that and it'd be worth maybe $50,000, that kind of thing. And then, see, when you're doing all this, if the police arrest you for theft or something, then you start paying off the police. And then if some of your people get called into court, you corrupt the judge who gives your people a little slap on the wrist and go your way, that kind of thing. So it's a poisonous influence in the whole city. And so I figured I'll study that and see if I'm right and think if the shape-up is either the cause of all this or facilitates it. And then I'll compare that with the West Coast, where the way you get hired is through a hiring hall, where you're registered in the port by a joint committee of employers and the union, and you rotate people through this hiring hall in such a way as to equalize job opportunities. Now, that can lead to corruption too, but if you know that corruption is possible, maybe even likely, you can guard against that and do it in an open place. And then, so I took Seattle as representative of the West, because I knew people there, having been in the CIO in Seattle, and compared that with New York. So I thought, this ought to appeal to outfits like the Social Science Research Council and so on. But what I discovered was, whenever I made an application, it would go to this bastard Reynolds, who was the director of graduate studies.
He remembered your Studebaker.
So if I had any tendency to be hostile to people in power, that sure as hell reinforced it. But that was a great dissertation, and I managed to get the California Press to publish it. When I arrived here, I had a book under my belt already. Mm-hmm.
Did you interviews as part of that research?
Oh, God, yeah, I sure did. Mm-hmm. I didn't use a tape recorder. I figured I didn't know how to use one, and I figured it would intimidate people. I was asking people embarrassing questions.
Mm-hmm. What was your method of research? Was it when you did the interviews? Did you take notes?
I didn't. As soon as the interview was over, I would immediately head for a coffee shop, and I'd have some coffee, and I'd record what I had picked up in the interviews. It's not a very systematic way to do it. Certainly not anywhere near as good a way to do it.
Yeah, but at the time, you had a good memory, and you got it down a lot of those.
Yeah, it seemed to work pretty well, too. Mm-hmm. And then I would corroborate what I was told by talking to other people and reading. Did a lot of library research. Went to New York Library, Congressional Library of Congress, places like that.
Did the unions have any archives themselves, or not at that time?
The East Coast Union did not, but the West Coast Union did. Mm-hmm. They had a marvelous research department with a professional librarian running it, and so I was allowed to use their library almost as if I were on their payroll.
Mm-hmm. Was that in Seattle?
No, it was in San Francisco.
San Francisco. Mm-hmm.
So I had to spend a lot of time both in New York and in San Francisco and to Washington and whatnot.
After you, what year did you graduate? Your PhD?
Well, I got the PhD in 1952. The only even nibble, so far as the job goes, was at the University of Utah, and that was because the prof that I had studied under at the University of Washington recommended me to the head of the economics department, who's also the dean, tells you something about university it was. But he recommended me to the dean, and the Utah was considering the idea of establishing a labor management center, and what they wanted was somebody who would head it up, who wasn't going to cost them very much money. So if they could get some guy right out of his PhD program, he'd be happy to accept a modest salary, mm-hmm. and then they could. Now, I didn't want to head up any center like that. I didn't like the idea of being in administration. But it's the only job offer I had, so I took it, and it turned out they never, the center never got off the ground, so I wasn't corrupted by administrative.
This was at Salt Lake City?
Salt Lake City. Yeah, University of Utah. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty nice, although I think I had just been there a month or so. This was 1952, fall 1952. When the guy I was hired in the econ department to replace, he was retiring, said to me one day, he said, I've been invited to have a panel discussion on the campus radio, it would be like WKR, and I thought I'd invite you and one of the management profs to come on the program with me, and we can talk about the Taft-Hartley Law, which unions hated with a passion in those days, and management loved. So I thought, he said, would you like to do that? And I thought, yeah, this is a great way to, you know, bring myself to the attention of the local community here. So the three of us start walking from the building over to the radio station, and this prof says to the management guy, what would you like to talk about? I mean, I don't know, he had some answer to that. He says to me, what would you like to talk about? I said, well, are you familiar with the Taft-Hartley Law?
Yes, yes.
You know, Section 9H?
Not the exact one, but...
Well, that was the non-communist affidavit you had to sign every year if you were a union official. I said, I'd like to talk about that goddamn non-communist affidavit. I think that's an outrage, and the Supreme Court ought to strike it down, which they ultimately did. This guy damn near fainted. Oh, no. He said, you can't do that. No, that's too controversial in this community. And I said, okay, I'll talk about something else. So we get over there. We're sitting around the table. The light comes on. This prof says, isn't it wonderful to live in a society where free speech is protected and you can discuss anything you want to over the air and not have to worry about being persecuted? And I thought, I ought to strangle this bastard.
Everything but that section of the Taft-Hartley Act.
Yeah. So the only other... guy who headed up the... All the administrators at the University of Utah were Mormons in those mm-hmm. days. And so, I don't know that that's all that relevant, but the department needed to fill a couple of positions, so we were convening the faculty. I came there as an associate prof right off the bat, see, because I was going to build this labor management mm-hmm. center. Mm-hmm. So I had it both ways then, there.
So you got a promotion before you got there?
Yeah.
Before you came in as that?
Yeah, and I think in 2 years I had tenure there.
Uh-huh.
I gave up tenure and an associate professorship to come here as an assistant prof without tenure.
I see.
But it was a lot better job, and I'll explain to you why my days at Utah were numbered. So anyway, we convened the department to talk about filling these positions, and I think I recommended a guy, or somebody did, with a name that was pretty likely to be Jewish, like Old Goldberg or something like that. And the department said, oh, no, we're not going to consider him. And I said, why not? He says, well, he wouldn't be happy here. And I said, why don't we offer him the job and let him decide? Well, it turned out, and of course, that wasn't all that unusual back at that time, mm-hmm. 1952, to exclude Jews from university faculties. So I didn't make an issue of it, and I don't know whether he caught on to the fact that I thought it was pretty bad policy, but he and I got along okay. But then in my fourth year there, this was now 56, Eisenhower was president. The Secretary of Agriculture was a man named Ezra Taft Benson, who came from Utah. And I used to have one of these brown bag lunches with the people in the econ department, about eight of us, I guess, from time to time. So one day, I was having lunch with these guys, and it turned out that about a week before that we're having this lunch, Ezra Taft, Secretary of Agriculture Benson, had been asked, had been asked by a reporter, are you going to raise the support price for, I think, wheat? And he said, no, I don't believe the government should be in the business of supporting private enterprise. I'm opposed to that. That's Mormon doctrine, you know. Well, that struck me as something you'd expect from him. So I didn't think much about it. But a week later, I read that the whatever industry had asked for the subsidy had made a big contribution to the Republican Party. A day later, Secretary Benson raised the support price for that. So I'm having lunch with these guys, and I just read that in the paper. I said to him, I said, you know that goddamn Benson, he's got to be the worst fraud in that cabinet, and that's saying a hell of a lot. All but, I shared a room with him, Jack Mormon, you know, kind of backslid Mormon. All but this guy who shared this office with me got up and left. Not a word, just left. I said, what the hell did I say? He said, you criticized one of the 12 apostles. Oh, well, given my background, I have a picture of Christ. I said, I never said a word about it. 12 apostles.
Matthew, Mark,
he said, Benson is one of the 12 apostles, mm-hmm. and one of these days, he's going to be the president of the church. That's mm-hmm. tantamount to being mm-hmm. the pope. You know, they both have this idea of divine revelation. Mm-hmm. Mormons have that too. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh boy, I better get the hell out of here. Well, fortunately, just about the time I realized that, they were building a labor management center here, mm-hmm. which they started in 55, mm-hmm. and I was invited to join this faculty, so I grabbed the job, and that's how I wound up here. Yep,
that was my next question. How did you end up at Michigan State?
Yeah.
How did you first hear about the labor management program that was being developed here? How did you hear about it?
Actually, life is full of coincidences, and mine is full of them. In the Christmas holiday period in 1955-1956, I had gone back, I drove back from Salt Lake to New Haven to visit some friends at Yale, and as we were driving back, I thought, I'll go through East Lansing, Michigan, never having been here, never even heard of the place. But I had a fellow grad student who was in the social science department, a guy named Chuck Winston, who was on the faculty here. And he'd invited us to visit him, so I thought, I'll stop by there. So I stopped off, and we stayed here a couple of days, in the course of which he had several people from the econ department for dinner, one of whom was Walter Adams and Pauline. So Walter, who was tight with a guy named Killingsworth, who headed both the econ department and this new labor school, they were very friendly. So Walter suggested to Killingsworth, why don't we're hiring a bunch of people on joint appointments, econ and sociology, labor school rather, and sociology and like that. See, why don't we hire LaRue? He's got a book out and so on. He'd be a good addition to the faculty. So Killingsworth called me up and asked would I be interested in coming back here. And I said, who's picking up the tab for my trip? He said, oh, he said, we'll pay the fare, as if, you know, anybody ought to know that, which I didn't. So we met, and I was quite impressed with the Killingsworth, and because I'd read about him and heard about him. I had never met him before. But he offered me a job, and so I grabbed it.
Mm-hmm. And so you came in,
But see, if I hadn't stopped off on the way back from New Haven to Salt Lake, I don't think I ever would have been brought to Killingsworth's attention.
Was that the first time you'd met Walter Adams? Or
yeah.
How do you know it? Okay.
But the day we were having this dinner, I picked up the state news this guy had brought home from the campus here. And here was a letter from the football coach named Biggie Munn. Do you remember him?
Yeah. Well, I don't personally, but I know the name.
He was accusing a member of the English department named Adrian Jaffe of being a communist because Jaffe had written a letter to the state news saying football is overemphasized to the detriment of the academic program at Michigan State.
And he was accused of being a communist.
Jesus Christ, what kind of place is that? That happens to you. Mm-hmm. Well, they pointed out nothing came of that after all. and nothing did. But.
So it's interesting. You were an early reader of the state news, even at that.
Yeah, I sure was.
That seems to be an interesting feature when you first got here.
Yeah.
What was Michigan State like when you came? Or I should say, was your wife enthusiastic about coming too? Or
you know, I think she was indifferent, and that really is troublesome because she had. The University of Utah had a law school, and we didn't have any kids, and so she decided, why don't I go to law school? I could be a labor lawyer, mm-hmm. something like that. So she enrolled in the law school. She was sixth in her class, doing well, enjoyed it, part of a study group that included some people who were fun to be with and so on. And when I got this offer to come here, it didn't even occur to me to ask, does Michigan State have a law school, and what about her? It just didn't even occur to me. See, now it would occur to you, or your spouse would bring it to your attention, I think.
I'm sorry, I didn't ask her name.
Oh, Pat was her name.
Okay.
Pat Fall, she was the cousin of Albert B. Fall, who was a big figure in the Teapot Dome. He was secretary of the